This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So we've written our stories to entertain. These notions of glory and bull market gain. The teleprompt flutters, the power surge brings. An easy speak message falls into routine.
Welcome back to the fall 2013 season of Radio EcoShock, broadcast on more than 70 college and community stations around the world. This is Alex Smith. Big news continues to pour in from around the world. It's dizzying, isn't it? We've got a lineup of guests, experts, and activists waiting to make sense of it all. As I left for a break in July, I issued a special podcast on the global heat wave. If you missed that, join the thousands who downloaded it from our website at ecoshock.org. At the time of broadcast, the heat wasn't quite complete around the Northern Hemisphere. The Russian Arctic still seemed coolish, and there was no word from China, although Japan was suffering through record heat. 1 week later, Siberia went into an extended heat alert with hundreds of fires. Southeast China went down to a killer heat wave, setting the highest coastal temperature records ever seen on the Pacific coast of Asia. Now that's saying something, over 100 years worth of records. So the circle went complete. I'm not sure if this is absolutely new, but in 25 years of reporting climate news, I can't remember a super hemispheric heat wave like this. We can't call it a global heat wave because, of course, it's winter in the southern hemisphere, but we can call it global warming, and 2013 is the year when we entered into that certain phase of climate change. I'll have lots more on all that later in the program as we do a climate rundown with Paul Beckwith, a postgrad climate scientist at the University of Ottawa. Paul is a favorite climate correspondent, really linked into the latest in both extreme weather events and the latest science behind them, and of course we'll touch on what's happening in the Arctic as well. Meanwhile, we have the civil war in Syria, always threatening to grow larger. What a fascinating spiral of events coming out of that. We find Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, both promising and threatened Putin of Russia, a supporter of Syria's Assad. The Saudis reportedly offered to help fix the price of oil at a high level, which will affect our economy, of course, in return for Russian backing off from Syria. This is all in the mainstream press, including an illuminating piece by the top Telegraph financial correspondent Ambrose Evans Pritchard. There's more energy behind Syria than meets the eye. Everyone wants to control or stop a new natural gas pipeline across Syria. And did you know that Israel, along with Cyprus, has discovered a giant natural gas field in the Mediterranean? You remember Cyprus, the economy that crashed along with billions in offshore Russian accounts. Now Israel may have become a new energy power. There's a lot of debate within that country about how fast to drill and how to export this gas, but practically no talk about how even more fossil fuel emissions will drive Israel into heat exhaustion in the future. Go, go, go! More carbon for the atmosphere. Cities based on all this killer energy aren't going to do well in the next decade or two. China must be the poster child for the future of an industrial economy on steroids, with the shift to impure factory foods, just for example. 114 million people now have diabetes. According to a report in Bloomberg, September 3rd, 40% of 18 to 29-year-olds are pre-diabetic in China, ready to develop the disease, which will eventually cripple and can cause loss of limbs. That's just one example. We're not talking about the poison river or the hundreds of tons of poisoned fish always reported every week. Another expert warns that in 25 years, 25% of the Chinese population will be at risk of developing dementia. Barry Greenberg, scientific advisor to the Alzheimer's Society of Canada, says the global economy is at risk just from the booming dementia rates alone around the world. We are heading into decades of trying to cope with a sick society, even as energy looks to become rare and very expensive. Many of us suspect there are dark and challenging times ahead. Fortunately, we are a very adaptive species. We have a lot of power inside of us. Many of the answers are out there if we are brave enough to take them. Some involve more love than technology. During the coming season of Radio EcoShock, I'll be searching out the scouts, those people already living in the outposts of a survivable human lifestyle. Whether you plan on moving out or drilling down good plant roots right where you are, stay tuned for more Radio EcoShock. Before we look at world-changing climate developments with Paul Beckwith, the continuing threat of the triple meltdown at Fukushima, Japan, has taken some new twists. Let's go to one of the best analysts anywhere out there to get the big picture for Japan and for the whole Northern Hemisphere, and especially the West Coast of North America. No doubt you've heard more about the continuing nuclear disaster at Fukushima, Japan. Three nuclear reactors melted down in March 2011, a fourth had a fire and explosion in the fuel storage area. Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, has been struggling to contain radiation leaks ever since. Is Japan safe? Is the Pacific being polluted with radiation? What should we be looking forward to? I'm Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock welcomes back nuclear expert and whistleblower Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. Arnie, thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, yeah, thanks for being interested in this topic for a long, long time. Well, I appreciate coming back again.
It's going to take a long time. It's going to be as long as you and I are alive. We'll still be reporting about Fukushima. Well, I know you have some good news about reactors in the United States, but first let's look at the world's largest nuclear disaster, in my opinion. What are the media reporting about Fukushima Daiichi?
Well, after the accident, the mainstream media kind of let it go off the radar. And, of course, those of us who were aware of the sleeping dragon that it could become were constantly concerned. While Fukushima likely released a little less radiation into the air, it has released 10 times more radiation into water, into the ocean, than did Chernobyl. So we're dealing with an accident on par with Chernobyl. And while Chernobyl has almost stopped, Fukushima is still an ongoing disaster. So what happened that got the press's attention the last month was a large leak from one tank. And the radioactive concentration in the leak was extraordinarily high. Essentially, if you stood for 10 minutes next to the tank, the releases from the tank, you got a year's worth of radiation exposure. Another way of saying that is it was lethal in 4 hours. So this was really bad. Well, that's what ramped up the press interest. But in fact, that's just a drop in the bucket compared to the total amount of water that's been leaking into the Pacific for 2.5 years now. So the Pacific is contaminated, and that contamination is not abating. As a matter of fact, it's likely to get worse. We've got a wedge of radioactive material about halfway across the Pacific now, and it should hit the west coast of Canada and the west coast of the U.S. sometime in the next year. The radioactive concentration in that wedge of water is 10 times what it was from bomb testing. So we are seeing an appreciable increase in cesium concentrations and other isotopes in the Pacific. Now, the lesson here is the Pacific's a big place. And if we're contaminating the Pacific, can you imagine if this accident had happened on the Rhine or the Mississippi or the Great Lakes or the Danube? You would wipe out the water supply for a continent. And that's a risk that nuclear policymakers appear to be willing to take.
Does anyone really know, Arnie, where the leaked reactor cores are?
Well, I think they're still in the building, but the answer is no, no one knows. There's a thing called a containment building, and the nuclear reactors held together for about a day before they melted down, which means that the amount of heat that they had when they melted down was a little bit less. And there was water on the floor, which was able to cool them. But the net effect is that even if the nuclear reactors didn't melt into the ground, which we would call a China syndrome, it's just as bad anyway. Because what we've got now is a contaminated nuclear reactor core laying on the concrete, and that building, the containment building, is leaking like a sieve. So they're pumping water in, and it's laying right up against this nuclear reactor fuel, And it's leaking out all over the place into other buildings, directly into the groundwater. So to my way of thinking, a meltdown into the ground isn't necessary. We already have a situation that's almost as bad. We've got a meltdown on the concrete, water in contact with that concrete going everywhere. They need to keep adding water, too, because obviously this thing is hot. So in the process of cooling it, they create this huge amount of water, which then leaks into other buildings and directly into the ground and is contaminating the entire site.
So Fukushima is down near the ocean, but it's at the bottom of a big hill, and there's a whole flow of groundwater going through there. Now, the operator, TEPCO, proposed intercepting that groundwater above the plant to bypass the radioactive area and then pipe it somehow directly into the sea. Do you think that is viable? Could it help?
It was a good idea 2 years ago when I proposed it. I think now they've waited a little bit too long, and you know, the hill that the plant is built up against was actually a hill all the way to the water. So when the plant was built 40 years ago, they cut down the mountain and put these plants very close to water level, which, of course, made them susceptible to tsunamis. But what that's done is it's increased the hydraulic pressure of the water on the mountain behind it. So for 40 years, there's been 1,000 tons of water a day leaking onto the site. But because the plant was clean, it didn't matter. Well, now that 1,000 tons a day is leaking onto the site, but the plant is leaking into the ground. So the net effect here is that they're pushing water into the Pacific pretty much continuously, you know, day in, day out for 2+ years. Now, Woods Hole identified this a year ago when they said that, you know, the radioactivity in fish is not going down. And so Woods Hole was saying that that can only mean that the plant continues to leak. So nobody should be surprised here, you know, that scientists like me, the people at Woods Hole and others have been mentioning this groundwater problem for a year or two now. Yet, you know, Tokyo Electric seems to have magically just become aware of it. I think you're right, though, that the solution is not to prevent the water from going into the ocean. That seems to be everybody's focus, but to prevent the clean water from entering the plant. Now, what that means is they've got to get into the mountain and pull the water table down and pump that clean water out into the Pacific before it can enter the plant. That'll have the effect of dropping the water table on the site and gives them a chance anyway to prevent all this water from building up. Right now they got 380,000 tons of water in tanks on that site. And the tanks are not seismically qualified. So if they have an earthquake, it's likely that those tanks will fail and all that water will run right across the surface directly into the Pacific. So it's an ongoing clear and present danger, and yet Tokyo Electric doesn't seem to want to make the problem go away quick enough.
This is Alex Smith. I'm talking with nuclear expert Arne Gundersen from Fairwinds Associates. Let me just read you a quick quote from the Guardian newspaper, September 1st. It says, TEPCO admitted recently that only two workers had initially been assigned to check more than 1,000 storage tanks on the site. Neither of the workers carried dosimeters to measure their exposure to radiation. When I read things like that, Arne, my feeling is that Tokyo Electric Power is just not up to the job of protecting us all. Do you think this accident requires an international response?
Yes, absolutely. Your reading and mine are right on the mark. You know, Tokyo Electric is, there's two problems. First, if they're an operating company, they claim to know how to operate nuclear reactors, although with Fukushima Daiichi's accident, that may be called into question too, but they're not an engineering company. And this is the biggest industrial accident in the history of the world. And we're asking a company with really no engineering expertise to try to solve a very complex problem. So that's problem number one. They are not up to the task. But the related problem is that the Japanese government isn't giving them enough money to solve these problems. They believe that Tokyo Electric should fund this cleanup itself. Well, this is a $100 billion cleanup on the site and $500 billion U.S., if you look at the state, the prefecture of Fukushima. And Tokyo Electric doesn't have the resources to do that. So they've been hamstrung by money And my contacts at Tokyo Electric are telling me that part of the problem belongs with the Japanese government, who simply hasn't been funding this effort adequately. So when you hear two people walking around, you know, kicking the tires once a shift, that's an indication of, one, incompetence, but two, they don't have enough money.
In a previous Radio EcoShock interview, you said the Japanese should start unloading nuclear fuel bundles from Reactor 4 as a priority before that building collapses. Are they doing it?
Well, they're planning as of November to begin to do it. So they've made some progress on that. I think they're belittling the complexity of the task. You know, if you think of a nuclear fuel rack as a pack of cigarettes, and if you try to pull a cigarette straight up, it will come out. But these racks have been distorted. So now when they go in to try to pull the cigarette straight out, it's going to likely break and release radioactive cesium and other gases, xenon and krypton, into the air. So I suspect come November, December, January, we're going to hear that the building's been evacuated, they broke a fuel rod, the fuel rod is off-gassing, we have to wait a couple days, and then they'll go back in. So I suspect we'll have more airborne releases as they try to pull this fuel out. If they pull too hard, they'll snap the fuel. And I think the racks have been distorted, the fuel has been overheated because the pool boiled, and the net effect is that it's likely that some of the fuel will be stuck in there for a long, long time.
And I should point out to listeners that you were a fuel rack expert in the nuclear industry, so you know what you're talking about. Now, when the reactors blew up in March 2011, there was substantial radiation measured on the West Coast, right across the U.S. and even around the world. What have you heard about more recent pollution of the Pacific Ocean, and do you think it will reach North America in any amount that matters?
Yes, scientists had radiation detectors up in Seattle. Essentially, at the end of March all the way through April, we were able to determine that people in Seattle breathed in about 10 hot particles a day that wafted across the Pacific and would lodge in their lungs. We also had samples as far north as Vancouver and as far south as Portland, Oregon, that confirm that, you know, significant amounts of cesium, at least, and other isotopes were deposited on the soil after the accident. So now we've got a situation where we've got this wedge of water heading across the Pacific. And really, in the history of science, we've never seen anything like this. What I've been asking people on the West Coast to do is to contact their elected state representatives, or, you know, in your case, your province representatives, and get them to sample fish. You've got fish going out into this plume, eating other fish, and of course it goes up the food chain to the salmon and to the tuna and to the swordfish and things like that. I've also asked people on a national level to get a national fish monitoring program going. I think it's a disservice to the citizens of Canada and to the citizens of the U.S. that we're not getting this information. You know, the party line is officially, don't worry, we've tested it, the levels are low. Well, tell me what the number is, so I can watch the trends. You know, as a scientist, I want to know just how fast the cesium is working its way into the food chain. But the elected officials, both at the state and province level and at the national levels, are not providing us with that information. I don't even know if they're taking that information, but they certainly are not giving it out. And I think a transparent process will go a long way to alleviating fears about, you know, contamination in the food chain. Or, you know, we may show that we have a right to be afraid, in which case, you know, a transparent process would show that as well.
Now, before we move on to some better news about American nuclear power, is there anything else that you would like to add about Fukushima?
It ain't over. We're going to see problems coming up at Daiichi for years to come. I think the best solution is to basically entomb the plants within the next couple years. And by that, I mean, after they get the groundwater down, so there's no more leakage into the groundwater, fill them with concrete and walk away for 100 years. These plants are so radioactive that they're highly irradiating the Japanese workers who are on those sites. And I think it does a disservice to, you know, thousands of men and some women who are being exposed to extraordinary high levels of radiation. you know, it, ultimately it affects the Japanese gene pool, and none of us want to see that happen. So what I hope happens is that Tokyo Electric decides to entomb the four reactors for, you know, upwards of 100 years and then go back in. 100 years from now, the radiation levels will be one-tenth what they are today. And, of course, that means a huge change for worker exposures. And the other issue, of course, is the liquid releases into the ocean. And I understand that just this week, right after the 1st of September, the Japanese will be releasing a plan on how to tackle that. And the good news is the government is stepping up and saying it has to spend some money. The bad news is it took the government 2 years to step up and say it has to spend some money.
Okay, now, Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, you've been an expert witness on the Vermont Yankee reactor. You called for it to be shut down. Why, and what are the new developments there?
Well, Vermont Yankee's owner, a company called Entergy, 2 weeks ago announced that it was going to shut the plant down when it ran out of fuel in October of 2014. In other words, they had to buy new fuel in order to get another 18-month cycle out of it. And it was, rather than buy new fuel, they determined that they would just let the plant run down and cease generating about a year from now. It's a trend in the nuclear industry. In the U.S., we had 104 nuclear plants at the beginning of 2013, and now we're down to 99. We've lost Crystal River, and that was shut down by Duke because it had a major flaw and it was too expensive to fix. We've lost San Onofre 2 and 3. Those both had major flaws that were too expensive to fix. And I testified on all three of those. And we lost the Kewaunee plant out in Wisconsin because the utility determined it was just too expensive to run. And Vermont Yankee's kind of in between. One, it's expensive. It's a small plant with a large staff. But the other thing is they needed to make large cash improvements to the plant, on the order of $200 million. You know, why would you invest $200 million more in a plant that's already 43 years old when one breakdown of something else can shut you down forever? So their position was it makes better economic sense to run it down and put it in a decommissioning status. The big issue here in Vermont now is, what does that mean, decommissioning status? Entergy is saying that they want to keep the plant there for 60 years so that they can get enough money together to completely dismantle the plant. Of course, the state of Vermont doesn't want this carcass of a plant on the banks of the Connecticut River for any longer than 10 or 15 years. So the battle in the future here and at San Onofre and at Crystal River and at Kewaunee is why in the world did the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission allow a 60-year cooling-off period so that utilities could get enough money to decommission these plants? What it does is it the generation that used the power, you know, people like me, will be long dead by the time the decommissioning occurs. So the costs are generationally transferred down to my grandkids. And I don't think that's fair. I think if you incur the, quote, benefit of nuclear power, you should also pay the costs of nuclear power and not generationally transfer those costs down, you know, to grandkids.
So, Arnie, what's coming up on the nuclear calendar? Are there dates we should watch for or upcoming conferences of interest?
The big thing is there's a paper out by someone named Dr. Mark Cooper. And Dr. Cooper and I testify a lot, and he's a really brilliant guy. He works as an adjunct faculty at the Vermont Law School. And he published this paper that predicts that 30 nuclear plants in the U.S., so 30 out of 100, are on the verge of shutting down because they're no longer economically viable. So I think that we're not done with the nuclear plant shutdowns in the future. We've got many old plants that are exactly like Fukushima Daiichi. We have 22 plants like Fukushima Daiichi in the United States, all of which need enormous improvements over the next couple years. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is allowing these plants to not make any changes until 2019, in large part because they're pro-nuclear and they want to keep these plants running for as long as possible. But at the end of the day, they will become so expensive to fix that they'll be shut down, which is what Mark Cooper is saying. So I guess, you know, your listeners would should not be surprised if more nuclear plants are shut down in the future. The plants that occurred now were the initial earthquake, but we're going to have aftershocks for a year or two or three more, and as many as 30 U.S. nukes may be on the financial ropes.
Well, I'm hoping that they will close down before we have another Fukushima on American soil or Canadian soil or Europe or anywhere else in the world. But as you know, Arnie, I'm a nuclear activist. You are more of a nuclear expert, so we may disagree on that. But I'm severely worried about what's happening with nuclear power. And I just want to bring up as we wrap up this one last issue that someone else has raised, Guy McPherson, for example, that if we had a breakdown of our electric grid, for example, from a solar storm, which is possible, it's a far-out risk, but it's possible, then all of the nuclear plants around the world could melt down. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, it's called EMP, electromagnetic pulse. And if the sun sends an electromagnetic pulse out that's large enough, it could easily knock down the grid in, you know, Ontario or the east coast of the United States or something like that. The pulse shape is such that it would cause the nuclear plant to shut down, but it would not fry the electrical systems in the plant. It would destroy the transformers, which means that the plant couldn't ship power out, but it could likely keep itself cool off its diesels, assuming the diesels start. To me, the bigger worry is a nuclear weapon in space. I mean, if the Koreans really decide to do something, they could launch a warhead into space and fire it from orbit when they're over, you know, the east coast of the United States. That electric pulse from a nuclear weapon, not from a solar flare, but a nuclear weapon, is a different shape, and it fries electronics. It fries the integrated circuits in your computer. And if a country like Iran, you know, there's a bunch of them out there now who are nuclear-capable, Korea, chose to do it, there wouldn't be any damage on the ground, but the net effect would be that all of the computer networks, including the safety systems in a nuclear plant, could be jeopardized, and that could cause a meltdown. So one hopes that our opponents in this world are not that nefarious, but if you're concerned about a gross nuclear meltdown of many plants, likely not a solar flare, but likely some sort of a warlike action from Iran or North Korea or someone like that.
Of course, whoever did it, we know that the nuclear radiation would not be limited right to wherever the accident happened. It would be horrible there, but it would still flow right around the northern hemisphere and get out into the oceans, as we've seen at Fukushima. So I hope we don't experience that, and I hope we make it with a clean, orderly shutdown of the plants that are the most dangerous, at least for the start. Arnie, I want to thank you so much for all you do. I hope you're going to join us again as this disaster continues. I want to tell listeners that they can find out a lot more about Fukushima and all the things nuclear at your website at fairwinds.com, and that's fair with the letter E after it, and then winds.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, Arnie.
All right. Thanks for having me. And again, thanks for caring about this.
Well, I do care about our world, and I know our listeners do, so that's why we do it. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Radio EcoShock will be right back with the wrap-up of summer 2013. All the heat, floods, fires, and storms you can handle.